Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And if you're looking for a detailed breakdown of the House Republican bill on Obamacare, not today. We need a little time to digest things like that and see how important things like the Congressional Budget Office score play out. So there's plenty of time for that. But today we've got three excellent stories for you nonetheless, starting with the good martini. Let's go to the Politico story on this. President Donald Trump on Monday retreated behind closed doors as he reissued his travel ban executive order with significant concessions adopted after his first directive was halted by a firestorm of controversy and a fusillade of legal actions. Wow, the thesaurus is widely in use over there at Politico. The new order exempts existing visa holders from travel limits and removes Iraq from the list of seven Muslim-majority countries whose citizens Trump barred from entering the U.S. in a hastily signed and chaotically implemented order issued just a week after he took office. The new order will put a 90-day hold on issuance of visas to citizens of six countries: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. It also stops refugee admissions worldwide for 120 days. So clearly Politico is not subjective at all on this story. Jim, it looks like there's a lot more thought put into this one, more details, more supporting evidence for it. We made the argument that despite what you thought of the order, Trump had the legal authority to do what he did before. It looks like he's on even stronger ground now and in a way that should create less controversy.
I'm looking at the Washington Post editorial board here. You all remember, democracy dies in darkness. So you have to turn on the light a little bit brighter as you read the Post these days. Mr. Trump's second order may be on firmer legal footing than the first, but it's no less counterproductive. Okay, what I take from that is that we can't find a legal objection to this.
Right?
Because if there was one, they would bring it up. They're not going to cut them any slack on this. So if they can't find that, that's a pretty good. So now we're in the, well, you don't think it's a good idea. Okay, I think we all kind of figured that from the editorial board of the Washington Post. I think what jumps out at me, the ban, while doing virtually nothing to deter terrorist attacks in this country, aids the recruitment efforts of the Islamic State and other extremist groups by substantiating their case that anti-Islamic bigotry thrives in the United States. Greg, I'm a little tired of being told that ISIS recruitment is all our fault.
Right?
At any point, can we blame the people who join ISIS for saying, hey, I don't know if you noticed this, these people behead people, right? They set Jordanian pilots on fire. They try to wipe out the Yazidis. They steal girls and kidnap them into sex slavery. And you sign up with it. Well, America's being unfair. America's really being discriminatory. So I had no other option but to join the world's most notorious terrorist group. You know, you want to talk about infantilizing the Muslim world. You want to talk about just, you know, not holding anybody responsible for their actions. Hey, look. I got my beefs with Trump and the way he goes about things. I think the rollout of the first executive order was a train wreck from start to finish. But we have the right to pursue the policies that we think are going to protect us most. And we can't spend a lot of time sitting here thinking, well, how is the average angry young man in Cairo going to feel about this? Right? We can't, this might offend them. And the only way they could deal with that offense is by joining a terrorist group that's trying to kill us. No, this is not the way the world works. At some point, you have to blame the people who join ISIS for the decision to join ISIS. So if this is the strongest argument against the travel ban, then it doesn't really move me. And also, worth noting, all of these things are pretty much temporary while we work out better vetting and screening procedures. Is anybody opposed to vetting and screening procedures? Does this seem like, are we actually continuing an open door policy, which, nah, come on in, we'll check you out later? No, this is perfectly logical. This is perfect sense. If you don't like the way Trump rolled it out, fine. But they did their homework on this one. Look what happens when you consult with lawyers at DHS. All of a sudden, the other side doesn't have any easy handholds to argue against this. So I like everything that's in it, particularly the steps on Iraq, helping out our old translators, people who have helped us. Looks like obviously that was Mattis weighing in on that. Look, this is a major step in the right direction for the Trump administration. So I'm going to salute them for getting it right the second time. And look, for almost any policy you do, it's not like these things are etched in stone tablets. You can go back and change these things. So, you know, an undisputed good job, Trump administration. I much prefer careful, deliberated, gradual rollout of these big policies rather than surprise on a Friday in order to mess up airports as much as humanly possible.
Or our weekends with all the coverage and all the protests. So that was also very welcome. Mm. Mattis weighed in. No report here if tears were involved, but he got his way. So
I'm coming to you with tears in my eyes.
And that was an original story from Iraq. Jim, just as an aside here, we talked about the Post and the next story we're going to be quoting from the Post as well. Did you hear the exciting news that they're going to make a movie now out of the Pentagon Papers called The Post with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep? I'm sure lots of conservatives will flock to that one.
Yeah, it seems like a really odd time to do that. I guess the idea is, oh, the heroism of leakers and things like that. You know, is it just some rule that every couple decades, Hollywood's got to make some sort of film glamorizing the Washington Post?
I guess so.
You know, the other thing, you know, to give credit where it's due, you want to see a fine film about journalism, Shattered Glass, starring Anakin Skywalker, a.k.a. Hayden Christensen. It's actually about the New Republic and Stephen Glass, the guy who made up stories and did not get caught for a very long time. A decent depiction of what life at magazine journalism is, and probably a good cautionary tale about it. Because honestly, if you ask me, I don't know if journalism needs more stories encouraging people. If you're really heroic journalism, you go out and you try to find a scandal, Robert Redford will play you in the movie. And let's point out, it's Robert Redford at his peak, not, you know, old crotchety Robert Redford playing Dan Rather these days. But instead, the idea of, oh, Tom Hanks will play you and you know, all kind of stuff, you end up glamorizing the wrong kind of journalism. I salute Shattered Glass as a fine cautionary tale of too much praise to a young journalist who, oh, by the way, all of his lies tended to comport with the liberal worldview. The stories about CPAC and things like that. So that's our film corner for today's Good Martini Today.
That's fascinating. I don't know if I'm more surprised by the fact that I wasn't aware of the Shattered Glass movie or that Hayden Christensen actually made a third movie somewhere along the way.
Oh, my goodness. You'd actually walk away with this and say, wow, George Lucas is terrible. Now, maybe Hayden Christensen is this like whiny, emotionally manipulative, pathological liar. And if that's the case, then he's just, you know, getting typecast. But he's actually really good in this. And it'll make you look at this and say, wow, George Lucas can't direct actors to save his life.
All right, on to the bad martini now. And this is also from the Washington Post with a little help from Ed Morrissey over at Hot Air. Ed writes, in case anyone wondered what the Kim regime was up to yesterday, the North Korean state-run media would like to clear up the confusion. The simultaneous launch of 4 mid-range ballistic missiles was a practice run for the war that Kim Jong-il insists is coming, a little target practice using Uncle Sam as a bullseye. The firing range practice got a significant response from the U.S. that raises the stakes for both China and South Korea. Here's where the Post comes in. North Korea was practicing to strike U.S. military bases in Japan with its latest barrage of missiles, state media in Pyongyang reported Tuesday, and it appears to be trying to outsmart a new American anti-missile battery being deployed to South Korea by firing multiple rockets at once. Kim Jong-un presided over Monday's launch of the 4 missiles, quote, feasting his eyes on the trails of ballistic rockets, the Korean Central News Agency reported in a statement that analysts called a brazen declaration of the country's intent to strike enemies with a nuclear weapon if it came under attack. The KCNA also said, quote, if the United States or South Korea fires even a single flame inside North Korean territory, we will demolish the origin of the invasion and provocation with a nuclear-tipped missile. So clearly, they're not rattling the saber at all. Jim, it's one thing to wonder if they could reach the west coast of the U.S., American targets, as well as our own allies in South Korea and Japan, a lot more concerning.
This is the sort of thing I could easily see the Trump administration doing as a potential solution to this perpetual crisis on the Korean Peninsula. So China, more than anybody else, has leverage over North Korea. They may not have perfect leverage over North Korea, but we know Chinese aid is basically what keeps them economically functioning. The idea of how much North Korea is grateful or respectful of China is debatable. If I remember correctly, there's like one rail line that connects China and North Korea on their border. And so they sent over aid on a train one time. It went across the border, and then the engineers came walking back. And the Chinese official was like, what happened? And the engineer said, they decided to keep the train. North Korea is like, even the Chinese find North Korea crazy and unpredictable and disruptive and all that stuff. But they have much better influence over them, certainly, than we do or South Korea does. China doesn't like seeing Japan and South Korea militarized. They don't like seeing defense buildups. They don't like seeing a more aggressive or assertive posture. And they don't like the various anti-missile systems we're trying to install in the Pacific Rim. Well, China, if you don't want people to militarize, then you got to do something about the maniac who's living next door to you. Right? Because all of those missile defense systems and that defense buildup could cause a headache for China someday. But if you don't want them to do that, then you got to lean on your crazy little buddy. You've got to do something about this. Otherwise, America and Japan and South Korea and the rest of our Pacific allies just aren't going to have a choice. We're going to have to do these sorts of things. And I could see the Trump administration kind of trying to put that forth, just put that decision in front of Beijing and say, look, guys, your decision how you want to handle this. We would rather not deal with North Korea. We know you have a better relationship with them. We know you have a better chance of talking them down before somebody gets seriously hurt. But if you refuse to do that, we have no choice but to do this the hard way and build up our defenses, and we know that aggravates you. I'd be curious about how the Beijing response would be to that, and it sounds like the sort of carrot-and-stick approach that I could see the Trump administration attempting. In addition to film reviews, you get proposals for, Pacific Rim Peace. The full service day of the Three Martini Lunch.
I like it because there's always been a little footsie with China about this, but there's never been a ton of pressure on them. It's always just kind of hoping they would do it rather than creating incentives for them to do it and giving them really good incentive to do it. But let's move on to the crazy martini now, Jim. I'm sure you've had this marked on your calendar for a long time. Tomorrow is a day without a woman. The big protest, not only in Washington, but I'm assuming in many other places around the country and perhaps the world. And now it has affected school children. Again, the Washington Post. They get every martini today. A Northern Virginia school system is canceling classes for all students Wednesday after numerous teachers requested the day off to join a national day of protest called A Day Without a Woman, in which organizers are urging female workers to stay home. School officials in Alexandria announced Monday that about 300 staff members were seeking to take Wednesday off, too many to be able to open schools. The officials attributed the high number of requests to the demonstration, which was organized in conjunction with International Women's Day and is intended to show the importance of women in the labor force. The majority of the 300 are teachers, officials said, comprising a sizable share of the 1,400 teachers in the school workforce. The system has about 15,000 students. The Weasley statement from the Alexandria superintendent, Alvin Crawley, is, quote, "This is not a decision that was made lightly. We have been closely monitoring requests for leave on March 8th, including communicating with school leaders and our education association. The decision is based solely on our ability to provide sufficient staff to cover all our classrooms and the impact of high staff absenteeism on student safety and delivery of instruction. It is not based on a political stance or position," right, unquote. Kudos to the Post for actually deeper in the story, pointing out parents in Alexandria were left to search for childcare and some teachers worried about how low-income families would manage. One parent is Tracy Kennedy, whose son is in the fourth grade, says she could lose nearly a full day's pay because she bills by the hour and gets no paid time off. She says she is disappointed in the school system permitting teachers to take the day off, although officials said they had little choice in the matter. Kennedy, the parent here, saying, "We have shown our teachers that they can basically rip the rug out from underneath our educational system and that it's permissible. The protesters are trying to support women," she said, "but women are the ones who are suffering." Jim, longtime listeners know that you are a resident of the Yuppie Acres neighborhood of Alexandria before moving onto finer pastures. What do you make of this?
Sure. Well, first of all, what should we make of A Day Without a Woman, or as I call it, high school? So on the one hand, look, I'm not enough of a male chauvinist to completely deny that women have it rough. Women get treated badly by bosses sometimes, by other males sometimes. It is not easy to be a woman. Thus, men, be nice to the women in your life. Having said that, I don't really see what everybody taking the day off is going to do to teach a bad man or to teach these oppressive forces much of a lesson, because the primary effect would be how much traffic won't be that bad. All of a sudden, everyone's going to have a much easier time getting around and all kind of stuff, which is one of the major impediments in Washington, D.C. life. Yes, I used to live in Alexandria. My older son went to a public school there. He had a very fine teacher. It was a very wonderful time. But I'm going to observe something, and this is kind of this is why you listen to the Three Martini Lunch podcast, because you get a preview of articles before they appear on National Review Online, because I'm still writing them. Greg, my son went to a very fine school in our neighborhood, but Alexandria Public Schools aren't actually that good. There's a big variety in there. Now, because Alexandria is a very wealthy community, it's got, you know, charming old town, and a lot of federal workers live there, and there's a lot of old money. People think Alexandria has a really good public school system. It really doesn't, at least not compared to Fairfax County, Arlington, and most of the D.C. area. Or maybe I should say, Alexandria has really good schools. It's just at the high school and arguably middle school level, they're all private schools. If you the Alexandria public schools have been wide-ranging and not so good in a lot of cases for a long time. And the reason they haven't been fixed is that everybody with the money and means and who would care about it either moved out of the district or they sent their kids to private school. I went back to more than half the students in Alexandria Public Schools qualify for assisted lunches. People would not have expected that, I suspect.
Right.
And so as a result of that, you look back, you know, school violence, the violence in Alexandria Public Schools higher than you would think. Test scores are pretty mediocre. They're basically about 9 to 10 points below the state average in almost every category. They got real problems. And this is, you know, this is not a lack of funding. They spend about $17,000 per student. Class size is pretty darn small. They average 18 students in elementary school, 20 in middle school, 22 in high school. But if you know, there's a reason people move out of Alexandria when their kids get older, because they don't want to pay for private school and they don't want to send their kids to public school. These are big problems facing Alexandria Public Schools. These are concrete problems. These are problems that have existed for a really long time. And these are problems that are really the job of these teachers and school staff and administrative staff. This is their job to fix. The sexism of the Trump administration, right? This sexism in society is not really your job to fix. And this is a very vague, amorphous concept to deal with, right? Yeah, what is it going to take to fix this? You know, look, Trump tweeting, he's going to say obnoxious things. He's going to say terrible things. There's really not that much you can do about that, Alexandria teachers. But you know what you can do? You can educate the kids right there in front of you. You already have a really important responsibility. And I'd really prefer if you'd stop, if you wouldn't take time off of that responsibility that you're being paid for to deal with this esoteric, generic, culture-wide issue of sexism. So... and the fact that the first thing, who are you really sticking it to by taking this day off? Well, as you pointed out in the introduction there, Greg, parents in Alexandria. Hey, do you know how much of the vote that Hillary Clinton got in Alexandria last year, Greg?
Pretty high.
76%. Boy, you really showed those Trump supporters, huh? You know, you really hit those guys. So it seems enormously counterproductive symbolism. Dealing with an amorphous problem instead of dealing with the very real problems right there in front of them in their workplaces every single weekday. The only way this can become completely justified in my mind, Greg,
yes,
is if it snows tomorrow. Because there's nothing, finally, the other kind of snowflakes are figuring out how to shut down Alexandria Public Schools.
Very, very good. Very good. I love the line here. This is going back to the parent. She said she is disappointed in the school system permitting teachers to take the day off, comma, although officials said they had little choice in the matter. Jim, I'm not in management, but I'm pretty sure you have to put in for leave. There's one of two answers you can give. And once a number of people say they want off that day and you've approved it, everybody else gets a no. That's the option that you had.
I'm going to go out on a crazy limb and assume there's some sort of like teachers union contract that forbids that. But yes, that would absolutely make sense. And the other thing is, by the way, I'm going to do something very uncharacteristic here. I'm even going to, qualitatively defend the day without a woman protest. Right there on their webpage, it says not everybody's going to be able to take the day off, so wear red. You know, if every teacher decided to wear red to honor this day, would any of us be objecting? No, it's your right. Go right ahead. You wear red. You go right ahead and you do that. Send that signal. If you want to talk to students about it, go right ahead. You can do that. But in the end, I'm going to do something else even more uncharacteristic, Greg. I'm going to quote Bill Belichick. Do your job. right? That's what you're there for, right? This is supposedly your passion. I don't want to hear ever again from any Alexandria public school teacher how it's all about the kids and they put the kids' interest first. No, 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 no. When you're taking a day off to prove a political point, you're all about your interests, not the kids' interests. And I think, you know, that when next time it comes time to contract time, I'd like to see the Alexandria City Council keep this in mind. And you know, when you do these things that alienate parents, school and teachers and administrative staff, there are consequences down the road. Maybe you guys need to do a little more foresight, particularly since you're the ones who are supposed to be setting an example for our children.
Jim, there's no way to improve upon that other to say you had too much inflection in your voice when you quoted Belichick.
Do your job. Yeah. We're on to Cincinnati.
On that note, we'll reconvene tomorrow. See you, Jim.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.